Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, business, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on quantitative easing right after this. You know, 3,300 years ago, Moses instructed our fathers. He said, "You shall not have in your bag diverse weights, a great and a small. You shall have, or you shall not have, rather, in your house diverse measures, a great and a small. But you shall have a perfect and a just weight, a perfect and a just measure shall you have." Well, you know, our founding fathers at the Constitutional Convention in 1787 adopted that scriptural principle of law. When they put into our Constitution, at Article 1, Section 10, these 17 words, it says, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debts." Well, in 1933, President Roosevelt took our gold away, and in 1964, President Johnson took silver coin out of circulation. And in place of these just weights and balances, these two presidents introduced into our current practice the first, second, and fifth planks to the Communist Manifesto into our monetary system. And they gave us Federal Reserve notes in place of gold-backed treasury bills and clad coinage in place of silver coins. Now, in the intervening 70 years or so, we Americans have gone from being the world's number one creditor nation until today, when we're the world's number one debtor nation. Now, who do you think were the better financial planners for our nation, Moses and our founding fathers, or Franklin D. Roosevelt and Lyndon Baines Johnson? Now, if you'd like to learn more about hard money and how to use it properly, that's another of the many lessons that we teach here at the law school and our business school. We conduct that twice a year here at the law school. If you'd like to learn more, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package first? That's the place to start. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general, and it's educational, informative, and entertaining, and best of all, it's free, and you can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's 417-273-4967. Now, our business school is also available on CD, compact disc for adult homesteading. And if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there. That's georgegordon.org, and then click onto the archives page. Well, we're talking about quantitative easing, and I gave you the name and address, the internet location here for the Golden Jackass. It's not the, no, it's just goldenjackass.com. And you're looking for Jim Willie. He's got an archives page there. And you can see what he's been saying over the last 5 or 6 years, and then compare that to where you are today. Now, I'm going to switch gears here, and I'm going to flip over to Kitco. And then an article written by Toby Connor that deals with deflation, Never Had a Chance, by Toby Connor at Kitco.com. Now, remember I said the other day when I started this series of programs, I said, quantitative easing, it's a buzzword. It's a lie. It's a misrepresentation of inflation. What we're really doing here is inflating, and that inflation is going to come back and bite us in the butt. And typically it takes, you know, a year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years for these events to transpire. Writers who were telling us in 2001, 2, 3, 4, 5, you know, here's what's coming if our government continues these policies, and now sure enough, here's what's happened to us. God himself in the Bible said, hey, wait a minute, you know, don't use unjust weights and balances, thou shalt not steal. Well, okay, so we decided we're going to have fiat currency and we're going to steal. Well, all right, now there's a penalty for that. That's all that we're pointing out here. Now, if you're prepared to pay the penalty for the benefits that you receive, well, hell, stick with the program. You've got a winner here. You can't lose. Personally, I don't like the outcome of this. This 7% inflation per year, the collapse of our economy, two wars and a big war coming now with Iran, which probably is going to trigger World War III, I don't really want to get involved in that. I'm not interested in doing that. Having my 401k inflated out of existence, I don't think that's a good plan. Having my house foreclosed on and my job terminated, that doesn't strike me as being the kind of program I want to get involved in. Now, that's what's happening to us, and it's happening to us on a national level, and it's happening to us because of policies, economic policies that we've adopted and been following here for the last 100 years. We started this ball rolling down the hill in 1913 with the Federal Reserve Act. Well, there was an inevitable end to it. It's been a hell of a party. I mean, we've had nearly a 100-year party over here, and this has been a hell of a party. But I would like to point out to you that the party is over now, and now we're going to have to pay with the hangover, and we've got to pay with the side effects that come from it, and that isn't going to be very pleasant. Now, when we talk about deflation is a part of, it's the other side of quantitative easing. And I said the other day, if I had my druthers, I would take deflation over inflation anytime. That isn't going to happen, and we're going to have inflation, and that's what the powers that be have decreed, and that's what they've decided, and that's what we're going to get. So I'm preparing for inflation, and I expect a profit from it. But the profit that I make off of inflation is going to be made at the loss of other people out there who are going to lose their shirts. And I'm going to position myself in such a way that I benefit at their loss. And I'm sorry that that's going to come to pass, and I guess that's why I'm telling you the story now, so that I won't feel near as bad when I clean you out later. I mean, I told you. I told you this is what I'm going to do. Now, the big banks and the people in the know, the insiders, the Illuminati, they've staged this event, and they intend to make a lot of money off of it, and I think it's despicable, and I don't think we ought to do this. I think we ought to quit. But they couldn't do this to us if we didn't underwrite it. If you and I, the Joe Sixpacks and Sally Housewives of America, if we wouldn't do business with the banks and insurance companies, if we wouldn't do business with the government, they couldn't do this to us. So years ago, I closed my bank account, shut off all of my insurance accounts, and stopped doing business with the government, and I haven't been sorry. I'm not advocating that you do the same. I'm not here to tell you how to live your life. I'm just here to tell you that I have positioned myself to take advantage of you. So I want to tell you in advance. The other day, we were talking about these foreclosures. And one of my students wrote me a letter, and he said, I'd like to get into the appliance repair business. And I said, that's a hell of a neat deal. Let me tell you a secret here. Banks are foreclosing on houses at the rate of $1 million a year, and they're hiring companies to go into these houses and clean them out. All you got to do is get a list of the number of people or the people that are cleaning these houses out, because they're throwing all this stuff into a Dempsey dumpster and hauling it away. What you do is you walk in there first, and you buy this stuff for 10 cents on the dollar from the guy so he don't have to haul it away. So simple that is. Load it in your truck and haul it off. You buy it for 10 cents on the dollar, then you sell it for 50 cents on the dollar, and you net 40 cents. I said, I think that's a good plan. There's a lot of money being made out here on all these foreclosures. I'm sorry as hell that you people are being foreclosed on. Honest to God, I'm sorry that happened. But you brought it on yourselves. You did it. You went down and signed these contracts. And when you signed these contracts, you agreed to pay this interest. Remember? Okay, well, now your creator told you not to do that. He said, don't go surety, number one. Number two, don't ever pay interest. He warned you, and you wouldn't listen. So now there's an outcome that comes from that. Now, while they're foreclosing on you, then you have to leave because you got no place to go, so you're leaving all of your stuff behind, or a lot of it behind, you know, like washers and dryers and computers and television sets and stuff like that. I simply told my student, go in there and pay the guy that's got the contract to throw that stuff in the dumpster and haul it out to landfill, paying 10 cents on the dollar, and you walk out of there with $500 and take $5,000 worth of stuff, and then sell the $5,000 worth of stuff for $2,500. You're in at $5,000 and you sell it for $25,000 and you make $2,000. The bad news is that 25% of the people of America are unemployed. The good news is 75% of them are employed. And the 75% of them can afford to pay $2,500 for your $5,000 worth of goods. So that's the way that deal comes down. Now, lately, we've been hearing a lot about the Kondratiev cycle, Elliott wave super cycles, and the end of the world, and deflation, deflation, and deflation. Now, what the deflationists fail to acknowledge is that in a purely fiat monetary system, deflation is a choice, not an inevitability. So to put it in simple terms, if a government is willing to sacrifice its currency, there is absolutely no way deflation can take hold in a modern monetary system. No way. And it doesn't matter how large the debt contraction is, $10 trillion, $100, or $1,000 trillion, any government with a purely fiat currency can, with a stroke of a computer key, print enough money to wipe out all the debt. Now, granted, they will destroy the currency by doing so. But at some point, we're going to be faced with the choice of print or deflate. And I have very little doubt that Ben Bernanke will choose to throw the dollar on the sacrificial altar. Now, consumer credit isn't growing, you say. Consumers are deleveraging. Not possible to have inflation unless consumers are borrowing and wages are rising. Pure nonsense. So let's point out one indisputable fact, and then I'll delve deeper into this deflation-inflation argument, and where investors need to put their capital to protect themselves from the coming inflationary storm. Now, in a purely fiat monetary system, a government that is willing to sacrifice its currency can, if they so desire, print enough money to mail every man, woman, and child in the country a check for $1,000 or $100,000 or $1 million. And to do so would halt any deflationary force right in its tracks. Right in its tracks. And it would, for the most practical purposes, wipe out all consumer debt. Now you say, impossible. Well, the United States has already done it twice. It was called a tax rebate, in case you forgot. Tax rebate. Now what label you handle on these government payoffs, bailouts, stimulus, you can hang whatever you want on it. And the moral to the story is they're giving money away, and if they can give away $1,000, they can give away $100,000. In fact, I mentioned this to you the other day. I said, you know, as long as we're going to give away $28 trillion, why don't we just take $15 trillion and give the $15 trillion to all of the men and women of America who have a mortgage? I know it's unfair to all of those that paid their mortgages off. I'm not talking fairness here. I'm just talking common sense. We already gave this money to the bankers. Remember? $12.8 trillion, we just handed them the money and said, here, go spend it. Had we done the same thing, just give all of the people of America, we're going to nationalize the mortgage market anyway, that's what we've done. So if we're going to nationalize the mortgage market, let's give the people the money and let them go out and pay. Let the people owe the government the $15 trillion and let the government take the money from the people over time. It bails the banks out because now they've got the $15 trillion, but it also wipes out the mortgage debt. And the government doesn't have to foreclose on all these houses. They can let you live in these houses and pay them $100 a month forever. But the banks got the $12.8 trillion, plus they got to keep the mortgages. So now they're foreclosing on your mortgages because you didn't pay them. And they got the $15 trillion, they locked it up, and they're not lending it, which is what they said they were going to do. Remember, if we don't bail them out, they won't have any money to lend. Hell, they're all bankrupt anyway. All we did was postpone the inevitable collapse for about 3 or 4 years. That's what we did. It cost $15 trillion to postpone it for 4 years. And I'm sitting here saying, well, hell, we didn't need to spend a quarter to postpone it. We could have done that free. Now, we didn't. And, you know, the powers that be, they have the powers to do what we gave them the power to do. We gave them our power of attorney. That's when you elect your politician. He goes to Washington to make your laws for you. Your God told you, don't let people do that. I'm your lawmaker. You shall have no other gods before me. We said, oh, hell no, we're not going to go there. We're going to elect these lawmakers and make our own laws. Well, okay, now you've done it. But I want to let you know that your lawmaking process has been moved from your power into the hands, into the powers of the bankers. So it was a mistake to take this power away from God to start with. And now that you took it away from God and you assumed it yourself, the bankers took it away from you, and so now you're sucking the banker's hind tip. That's where reality is at. Now here's the thing. Where the inflationary forces show up is determined by who gets first use of the money. So far, that has been the banking system. And through the myriad bailout programs, the Fed has created money out of thin air, forced it into the insolvent financial system. This has resulted in selective inflationary forces being unleashed. Instead of loaning credit to consumers or businesses who don't really want it in the first place, the financial system has now plowed the money back into financial markets. That's the reason the stock market rallied 80% despite all of the flawed fundamentals. That's why oil rallied from $35 to $80 a barrel. Despite impaired fundamentals. And that's why gold is threatening to break out again to new historic heights. So if instead of forcing this liquidity into the financial system, it had instead been mailed to the average consumer, just mail the money out to all these people out here that have these mortgages on their houses, and then let them pay their mortgage off, they'd own the house free and clear. And if you send them the check, you know, you could take a note back and the guy owes the government the money just like they would on their school loan. I mean, what the hell difference does it make if the guy defaults on paying the government or he defaults on paying the bank? A default is a default is a default. If he defaults, then you can go take the house back and sell it to somebody else. But anyway, the house would be the collateral. As it stands today, the government gave the banks $12.8 trillion with no collateral. The banks still hold the mortgage, so the bank has the house for collateral on a debt that hasn't been paid. Now, here you are, the mortgage payer on the house. You've already paid the banks $12.8 trillion, and now the banks hold $15 trillion. They're holding your house. They never put up any collateral. You have to put up your house for collateral for your mortgage loan. The bank puts up zero collateral for the loan that you guaranteed to them. What in the hell kind of dumb business is that? Come on, wake up here. Well, instead of forcing this liquidity into the financial system, we could have mailed it to the average consumer. We would now be seeing real estate prices rising rapidly again. Food prices and gasoline prices would be going through the roof. Wages would be rising out of control. It's just a matter of who do you want to give the money to, Joe Sixpack on the corner or Chase Manhattan Bank? And our decision was, let's give it to Chase Manhattan. Okay, well, now you've got stagflation as a result. Where inflation shows up is a direct result of who gets first use of the freshly minted dollars. And I can assure you that we don't have an impending deflation problem. We have a rapidly approaching inflation problem and currency crisis. And I've said for a long time now that eventually the market's going to make Bernanke pay a terrible price for this insane monetary policy. That price is going to be a currency crisis in the dollar, and I think it's already begun. Now, while everyone was busy watching the euro crack during the first part of this year, what no one foresaw was that eventually that cancer in Europe would at some point in time spread to the dollar in North America. And it began 3 months ago, although no one has officially taken any notice of it yet. So next I'm going to illustrate the long-term cyclical nature of the dollar as cycles are now lining up perfectly, as they always have in the past, to bring on a major currency crisis in the U.S. dollar, much worse than what just happened in the euro. So first, let me show you a chart of the largest cycle. It's called the three-year cycle. And I've marked the last 6 3-year cycles. These have tended to bottom about every 3 to 3.5 years, with most running 3 years and 3 months. Now, the consideration here is that the next major 3-year cycle low is due next year, sometime around March to June. And as they say, the doo-doo is going to hit the fan when the dollar moves down into this major low cycle, and Bernanke's foolish attempt to print away the credit crisis is going to blow up in our face. By spring of next year, we're going to be mired in a full-fledged dollar collapse. And the first warning is going to come when the dollar breaks back below 80. That will signal that the current immediate cycle has failed. And as soon as that failure appears, we can close the door on the dollar. Now, we should first see a test of the all-time lows by late this year when the next larger yearly cycle is due to bottom. After that, we should have one more leg down into late spring or early summer that I expect will send the dollar to new all-time lows. Now, the only way to abort this, to prevent this from happening, would be for Bernanke to immediately start withdrawing massive amounts of liquidity from the market. That wouldn't stop the 3-year cycle from coming, but we might have hope that the dollar could hold above the all-time lows, and we might avert or at least reduce the damage that will be caused by the impending currency collapse. But if Bernanke were to stop the printing presses today, then deflation would take over. Well, the only way to keep the economy from deflating is to keep inflating, and the minute we quit inflating to save the dollar, well, then we're going to have deflation, which is what I would prefer. If you were to ask me, I'd say, Bernanke, shut off the damn presses and let's weather the storm in a deflationary cycle. But, you know, people hurt when they do that. And, you know, you people are already hurting bad, and I don't deny that. So they're going to offer you the easy way out. And the easy way out is to inflate. And the president is doing that. He just did it the other day. He said, you got people that are out of work for 99 weeks. So we just passed a $26 billion unemployment bill. So the rest of us, the guys that are working, what we're going to do is we're going to put all these guys over here on this dole, $26 billion dole. So that means that we've got to run up more debt or we've got to pay more taxes to support these guys that aren't working. Boys and girls, that's not our problem. Our problem is production. You know, you can turn out money. All you've got to do is print it. But every dollar that's printed doesn't represent a new dollar's worth of mayonnaise, ketchup, or mustard on the shelf. And we have to have production that creates goods and services to at least the same value as the dollars that we're printing, and we're not. So when we print all these dollars, you have more dollars bidden for the commodities that are on the shelf, which are not being produced by the 10 million people that are unemployed. These 10 million people are all consuming, but they're not producing. Now, that's a conundrum because, you know, if you keep consuming but you don't produce, then whatever stocks you have stored up are going to run out, and that's where we end up with rationing. That's what's always happened in the communist countries. You know, when they run out, they stand in line to share the shortage. That's going to be a new experience here in America. So one of the first things I tell my students, you know, when they ask me, should I buy gold or silver, I tell them, do you have a 4-year food supply already stocked up? And they always tell me no. And they say, well, what are you going to feed your family with? And gold bullion? Well, no, I'm going to go out into the marketplace and buy the food I need with the gold. Well, that's the theory, but who told you there was going to be any food out there to buy with the gold bullion that you've stored? Because under hyperinflation, it'll drive the goods off the shelf. Under deflation, it'll leave the goods on the shelf because there'll be fewer dollars to buy it with. So those of us that have money will be able to go buy it. So otherwise, you're going to end up with lots of money and no goods. So you need to stockpile the goods. Everything that you people are going to be using over the next 4 or 5 years, you need to have it already stockpiled. If you don't have it, you're going to live without it. You're going to live. You're just going to live without it. If you don't have 4 pairs of shoes stockpiled, you're going to run out of shoes, and when they wear out, you'll be barefoot. And that's because 99% of the shoes consumed in America come from overseas. And when we stop paying our bills, they're going to stop shipping their shoes. See how simple that is? So he says here, I can assure you that Bernanke will do no such thing. For one, he has no idea that the crisis is coming. This is the same man who assured us back in 07 that the credit problems were contained in the subprime markets, and then in 06 that the real estate was not in a bubble. Now, second, if Bernanke were to withdraw liquidity, the country and world would quickly sink back into recession and then depression. So I don't think we have to worry about Uncle Ben turning off the printing presses. So what should investors do to prepare themselves for the approaching conflagration? Well, they must be invested in real stuff called commodities. And there's a reason that virtually the entire commodity complex was showing relative strength as the market put in the immediate intermediate cycle low in early July. Smart money was and still is positioning to weather the coming storm. Now, I'd also like to point out that the beginning phase of the crisis isn't going to feel like a crisis at all. The falling dollar will act to support all asset prices. We may even see nominal new highs in the stock market. Notice the term nominal new highs. You see, boys and girls, to counteract inflation, the stock market today, remember it peaked out at 14,000 and some change. The stock market today would have to be 16,000 just to keep even with inflation. And it's not, it's down around 10,000. So, boys and girls, every dollar that you're investing in the stock market is buying less and less real goods. That's what the bottom line is, which is fine if you're happy with doing that. You know, I talk to people all the time, and I point out to them, if you'd have invested money in the stock market, that's the Dow Jones in 1960, carried that through to 2000, you would at 5% a year, that's what it averaged. You made $73,000. You had 10, moved up to 73. God, you're a genius. Now, when you factor in inflation and capital gain tax, your real loss in purchasing power is $3,800. Your nominal profit is $60,000, and your real loss is $3,800. Oftentimes tell people this story, listen to this, and when I was a kid, you could buy an ice cream cone, double-decker ice cream cone, for 10 cents. So my granddad, he worked for $1.75 an hour in 1945. When he gave me a dime, I could go down to the ice cream store and get a double-decker chocolate ice cream cone for that dime. Well, the other day I went over to the ice cream store, and then they charged me $4, two scoops, coffee ice cream, $4, $2 a scoop. Well, let's figure out what that is, because our average pay today is around $18 an hour. So my granddad, if you take that 10 cents out of $1.75, and the last time I computed this, it was $3.35 for two scoops of TCBY. It's inflated even more than that now, but going back to the 335, if you compute that into the $17.58 that we were making here a couple, 3 years ago, we're now making 10 times more money, $1.75 to $17.50. But the price of ice cream didn't go up from 10 cents, you know, to $3. It went up to $3.35. What that means is that when I go into the ice cream store today and I work an hour, I get $17.50. But it cost me $3.35 to buy this ice cream cone. I can buy 7 ice cream cones for the $3.35. But in 1945, I could buy 17 and a half ice cream cones. Hell, I've lost 7 ice cream cones, haven't I? See where that? See, you're losing your real purchasing power. That's what the bottom line is. You're getting less ice cream. You're making 10 times more money, but you're losing the ice cream. You got to work longer now to make the same amount of ice cream. Well, that's not progress. That's a loss. Now, your government is taxing that away from you by printing this money. And Ben Bernanke promises that he's going to print more money and protect you from the ravages of deflation. Well, boys and girls, the inflation that we've suffered so far has already made great inroads onto our purchasing power. Do you think that more inflation is going to ravage us less, or is it going to ravage us more? My bet is that we're going to lose our heinies with more inflation. Hey, I got to give you a reminder here that you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has a radio log schedule and archives. All of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one by calling and asking for it. The number to call is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org. Click onto the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements, these recommendations that we give, don't mean that the authors or publications that we endorse are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour and editorial review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine or mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour or editorial review or the Law School, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, or you can call the Law School direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are talking about quantitative easing, and I first of all introduced you to Jim Willey of the GoldenJackass.com. There's no Z on that, just GoldenJackass.com, and that's Jim Willey. And we started there. Now, the second one is an article just put out here the other day. It's 8 September 2010, out on the 8th. Well, that was Wednesday. And it's written by Toby Connor. It comes on the Kitco website. It's Kitco.com. Then you want to find Connor, C-O-N-N-E-R. And then he wrote an article here called Deflation Never Had a Chance. Deflation Never Had a Chance. Now, I'm not concerned about deflation. I can weather the storm, whether it's deflationary or inflationary, but I think what we're looking for here is inflation. Governments have always opted for this in the past. It is the way governments will opt, and that's because they're going to pay all their debts off. They're just going to print the money up and pass it out, and then you're going to go into the store to buy something with it, and there isn't going to be anything there to buy. How do you like that? Now, the only way to abort this from happening is for Bernanke to start withdrawing these massive amounts of liquidity from the market. Now, I can assure you that he's not going to do any such thing. And second, if he were to withdraw this liquidity, the country and the world would quickly sink back into recession and in depression. No, they're not going to let that happen. They've said so. We're not going to let that happen. So what should investors do to prepare themselves for the approaching conflagration? They got to be invested in real commodities. And I said, okay, what do you want to invest in? Gold, silver? You want to get copper, palladium, platinum? Why don't you think about something that you're really going to need, like food, clothing, and shelter? Food, clothing, and shelter. Now, I'd like to point out that the beginning phases of this crisis isn't going to feel like a crisis at all. The falling dollar will act to support all asset prices. We may even see nominal new highs in the stock market. Nominal new highs? My God, it may hit 11, 12, 13, 14,000. And you people say, well, God, I see green shoots everywhere. And what you're looking at here isn't green shoots. That's icebergs. Icebergs is what you're looking at. But eventually, too much of a good thing will turn deadly, and the true scope of the mess that we're in will dawn upon the market. And at that point, the collapsing dollar will no longer support stocks. And then we can expect the market to roll over and begin the next leg down. In the ongoing secular bear market, and unlike stocks, commodities will thrive in a currency crisis, with one in particular shining above all the rest. And that one, of course, is the only real money, which is gold. Now, I might want to point out to you here that at this moment in time, just for your information, the gold-silver ratio is sitting at about 64 to 1. Let me see what I can do here. $12.50 was the price of gold here the other day, divided by $20 for silver in round numbers. That's 62.5 to 1. 62.5. Now, what that means is, except for your commissions, if you were to take 1 ounce of gold into your gold broker and put it on the counter, he'll give you 62 and a half ounces of silver. Now, the price of silver, when it tops out, it will top out in relationship to gold at 16 to 1. Sometimes it goes as low as 15, 14. And when it gets down around 16, that's the time to trade it back. Now, if you've got 62.5 divided by 16, and that'll pay you 3.9. So you'll trade your silver in, and you'll get 3.9 ounces of gold. So your 1 ounce of gold will turn to just about 4 at today's trading rate. 3.75 is a little closer to accurate, and then less your commission. But that's the way to profit in the gold and silver market. You know, a lot of times I hear people say, well, I don't buy gold and silver because it doesn't pay any interest. Those are people that can't count. Those are the masses out there. They don't know what the hell they're talking about, and they don't know how to count. I don't correct them because I'm not trying to educate people to making money. If you want to pay me and come to business school, I'll tell you what I know, but I'm not here to tell people free of charge, but I'm going to give you a little clue here. The gold-silver ratio hit 100 to 1 twice in the 20th century and 91 to 1. Once. Now, I use 60 as the breakoff point. Anytime I see the market 60 to 1, I convert immediately to silver. When I see the market down below 40, and I go to gold. So when the market goes from this present 62 down to 16, I'll trade the silver in and convert to gold. When I see the market move back up to 60, I will immediately convert from the 60 to 1. I'll convert that back to silver, and then go back and forth. Now, that could be done 6 times in the 20th century, and it nets about 3 times, and sometimes 4 or 5 times, but it always nets 3 and a little to boot. So if you do that 6 times, in other words, if you go from 1 to 3, and then 3 to 9, and then 9 to 27, and then 27 times 3, let's just write that as 27 times 3, that's 81, times 3, that's 243. So in 6 transactions, you go from 1 to 243 in 100 years. Nobody ever got paid that buying stocks and bonds. I'm telling you, there's more money in gold and silver just holding it back and forth and arbitraging it 6 times in 100 years than there is in all the money that you can invest in stocks and bonds. That stock market is just nonsense. It's good for stockbrokers, I don't deny that, and it's good for corporations. And there's a lot of people make a lot of money off of stocks, but it's not for plumbers, carpenters, and electricians and 401k holders. That's just nonsense. Silly nonsense on top of it. All right, now with that out of the way, let me flip over here. And let's talk about a gold standard, because the Bible talks about gold and a gold standard, and we used to practice that in this country. The gold standard, and it was Article 1, Section 10. No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt, hard money standard, I guess I should say. Here's another Kitco article. It's written by Paul Nathan, and then it was put out the 7th of September, 2010. Go to kitco.com. INDNATHAN, that's Nathan. Now, there are people out here that are advocating a gold standard. I'm one of them. You know, I advocate people use gold. I use gold. I'm on a gold standard. And I think I'm the only guy in Ozark County that's on a gold standard, and I practice gold and silver, and I'm happy as a clam at high tide. I don't care if there's anybody else in the county that practices gold with me. I don't need anybody else to do it. It would be good for them and good for me if they did, but they don't have to. Now, anyway, talking about the gold standard, today there's a growing interest in gold in general and the gold standard in particular as a replacement for the fiat standard that has failed so miserably over the last century. Yet any attempt at returning to the gold standard is being undermined by statements containing a host of errors, inconsistencies, and contradictions about gold. Statements made by those very individuals who are attempting to focus attention on gold and the virtues of a gold standard. And a bad argument advocating a return to the gold standard can be more harmful to the case for gold than no argument at all. Now, one such source of argument is that any gold advocates look at gold through the eyes of an investor rather than the eyes of an economist. Consequently, short-term, superficial, and sometimes misleading interest in gold is being encouraged at the expense of long-term education and a consistent economic theory. This approach must ultimately be counterproductive and self-defeating. The market is being saturated with literature containing misconceptions and inexact or incorrect terminology. And this has led to anti-gold positions, for instance, positions inconsistent with capitalism and a free market, most of which can be traced to poorly defined concepts, discussions drawn out of context, and misidentified cause and effect relationships. The following arguments, terms, and positions regarding gold, its present role in international monetary matters, and its proposed role in future international monetary reform have presented a recurring yet self-defeating defense of gold and the gold standard. And number one, he points out, is called the intrinsic worth argument. Intrinsic worth. It has been said that gold has intrinsic worth. And this argument represents a theory of economics that is inconsistent with the free market and consistently with the gold standard. Are consequently with the gold standard. This intrinsic theory of value holds that worth or value is contained within the object itself. It holds that economic goods possess value inherently, innately, despite the market, despite supply and demand. For example, in spite of men's values, choices, and actions. But a free market economist would reject this argument. They hold that no man can jump outside the market and declare what a particular commodity is worth. That all commodities are subject to the laws of supply and demand, that in economics there's no such thing as intrinsic worth, only market value. Worth means value. The value presupposes a valuer. As men's values differ and change, the market values change. As supply and demand conditions change, the exchange ratios of commodities relative to one another change. Gold is not exempt from these economic laws, and yet gold is often treated as if it, gold, were by using such unscientific terms as intrinsic worth, the gold advocate can only hurt his own case, and he has. The inability of many gold advocates to objectively answer the question, why gold, has led to the misunderstanding of gold and to such popular terms as gold, the mystic metal. Well, gold could not be called mystic if it were understood, and understanding begins with defining our terms. It's only through invalid concepts such as intrinsic worth that absurd terms such as mystic metal can gain popularity. Next is called the store of value argument. This argument holds that gold is a store of value, and it's often used as a substitute for intrinsic worth. Now, unless precisely qualified, the term can lead to the same errors, fallacies, and fallacious theories of the intrinsic worth argument. Thus, it may lead to a misunderstanding of the nature of money and of a proper theory of value. A store of value is a term often used by those who argue that gold will always represent a constant value. For example, that gold is a fixed yardstick representing constant purchasing power. Implicit in this argument, once again, is the idea that gold is intrinsically valuable, immune from the laws of the market. Not so. The possibilities of gold strikes, gold shortages, fiat money inflation, depression, deflation, fluctuation, and fluctuation of industrial demand, the relative market value of other commodities, and the differing knowledge, values, and expectations of men, all of these factors have the potential for increasing or decreasing the value of gold for individuals as it relates to their buying, selling, and trading of other commodities. So does this mean, then, that under a gold standard, the price index and the value of money will fluctuate? Well, it certainly does. Its purchasing power in relation to all other commodities will rise and fall over time. But this is precisely the beauty of the free marketplace, and it is the perfect case for freedom. And that is that prices are allowed to fluctuate freely, thereby corresponding to the constantly changing and the diverse values of every free individual in the marketplace. The advocates of a free market are not utopians. They are realists who recognize that there are no guarantees of economic security in this world. They're willing to accept the consequences of their actions and to accept the verdict of the free marketplace. Now, the advocates of a free market are not willing to trade their freedom for security. The store of value argument offers men just such a trade. While a gold standard does offer men more stability of value than any other free monetary system, still, it does not offer men a constant value. And there's no harm in stating that gold is a store of value so long as one knows and states exactly what is meant by the term. For example, that gold has stability of value and represents perhaps the best monetary method of saving. In a free society, one is certainly free to store that which one values, so long as it is understood that the value of one's savings is not immune from the influence of the marketplace. Then there are gold price predictions. You know, one way that pro-gold advocates have been trying to attract attention to gold is by arousing investor interest through predictions of higher gold prices. General estimates of prices are not by themselves harmful, but specific price predictions are indirectly harmful to the case for gold. The price of gold is determined by the values of those participating in the gold market. Nobody on earth, no group of mathematicians, no matter how many charts and graphs they may employ, no computer is capable of knowing the values of all of the consumers and all of the suppliers within the marketplace. Therefore, to try to precisely predict something as specific as a price is impossible. The fact is, individual values are constantly changing, just as the factors of supply and demand and the costs are changing. Individuals cannot have precise prior knowledge of prices, and by pretending to, can only confuse and undercut the entire concept and the basis of free market economic theory. There is no place for crystal balls in science, and that includes the science of economics. Those attempting to attract attention to gold by making precise price predictions are contradicting and obscuring the meaning of the free market and therefore undercutting the case for a gold standard. Then there's the legal tender argument. Many advocates of gold argue that if gold were made legal tender, not only would individuals be allowed to own and use gold as money, but this would necessarily lead to a gold standard. What is forgotten here is that this country's legal tender laws are precisely what prevents citizens today from using gold as money today. Legal tender laws established the legal precedent of coercive government monopoly over the issuance and use of Federal Reserve notes. The free market economist does not contend that gold must be money. He contends only that money must be market originated. The case for the gold standard is part of the broader case for commodity money. Consistent advocates of the gold standard hold that gold possesses these qualities and characteristics most conducive to the function of a medium of exchange. But they do not say that gold will forever be suitable as money, and neither do they hold that gold must be accepted as money, whether people want to accept it or not. They do not ask for the police powers of the state to enforce their idea of what money should be. Thus, they oppose legal tender laws. And furthermore, legal tender laws are not necessary. All that is necessary is that individuals possess the right of contract. For example, if a man contracts to pay 100 ounces of gold to another man who agrees to accept this sum in payment, the courts need only recognize what has been chosen as money and assure that the obligation be discharged. There's nothing wrong with defining the dollar as a specific amount of gold and declaring it as the nation's medium of exchange, but it's quite another thing to prevent competing monies, as is the case today. Legal tender laws are not what is needed to return to a gold standard. On the contrary, the legal tender laws, are one of the major factors today preventing the world from returning to gold. Well, I'm running out of time here, boys and girls. We'll have to take this story up next time. Let me remind you that this is from Kitco.com. This is Paul Nathan. You're looking for the Paul Nathan article. Kitco.com, September 7th, How Not to Advocate a Gold Standard. The other article you're looking for here is GoldenJackass.com, Gold, an Investment in Failure. Jim Willey is the author. Jim Willey. And then the third one over here that we're covering here, Deflation Never Had a Chance by Toby Connor. And that's also Kitco.com. All of these are free, by the way. Didn't cost anything. Just go to the website and tune in, download, and take a look. There's a lot of information out there, boys and girls, and it's good information that counters the propaganda that we get from Katie, Diane, and the CBS and NBC Evening News. Hey, I'm out of time. Let me give you a final reminder here that you have been listening to The Law Hour and Editorial Review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. And all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.